From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. In the war on terror, President Bush said, you're either with us or against us. The distinction is clear when applied to rogue states, but not so clear when applied to America's closest allies. September 11th revealed Britain, France, and Germany as hotbeds of terrorism. In this hour, how can the war on terror be waged on friendly soil? We begin with an admission today by the Bush administration that Osama bin Laden escaped during the Battle of Tora Bora. Martin Gelman broke the story today in the Washington Post. Earlier, I asked him how grave the error was and how Osama bin Laden got away.
We don't know how he got away, or I don't anyway, and gravest error in their view, and I have to emphasize this is not the Washington Post view.
Sure.
Because there is no more important target in al-Qaeda than the preeminent leader and founder of the organization. They had him for the one and only time we know of in their sights, and they were unable to capture or kill him. So that's a pretty big moment.
And one reason, you say, or the sources say, is that we failed to commit U.S. troops. We allowed the Afghans to do our fighting for us.
Well, that is what they did at Tora Bora. They had their reasons, but they've changed dramatically afterward, and there are many who say they've changed because of the lesson of Tora Bora. Ever since then, whenever they've had a big operation in Afghanistan, they've made sure that U.S. ground combat elements are a major part of it.
Was this hesitancy about committing U.S. forces part of the sort of pre-September 11th dispensation, which, according to which, you know, no casualties, painless war?
I don't actually know that, and I tend to doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this president was serious when he said he's willing to risk lives and spend lives if need be in the war. I think there were other things probably involved, and here I enter the realm of speculation.
Yep.
But I know that General Franks was very much had in mind previous experience with going into a country intending to be friendly and being perceived as an invader, and certainly Afghanistan has a history there. He did not want to go in his first major contact with the Pashtun majority forces.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the Northern Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And be perceived as a conqueror. So he wanted to show them, we're supporting you. He overestimated the confluence of interests between the United States and these three warring and somewhat corrupt militias that alleged that they were placing a cordon around Tora Bora.
You describe a long, I don't know if you call it logistical, but communications tale leading back all the way to Tampa, and you intimate, or the sources do, that this was part of the problem, that Franks was so far from the action that by the time the word got to him, it was too late.
The view in the military chain of command, as far as we can establish it, and we have pretty good line into this, is that that's the preeminent problem they had here. You had on the ground no one for the first 3 days and no one higher than a lieutenant colonel throughout. And the lieutenant colonel is not the guy who's going to pick up a secure phone and call General Franks in Tampa and say, sir, we've got to change something here. The lieutenant colonel's got to call some one-star in Pakistan who calls a two- or three-star at CENTCOM who filters a report up to Franks, and by then they've got options and opinions, but it's not a fast-moving operation.
Wasn't there a similar inhibition earlier when Mullah Omar had been targeted and before he could be blown up? I think he was in a building. They had to send the word up the chain of command to get permission, and by the time they got the permission, he was gone.
That does seem to be the case. It's somewhat different in that it's a jointly operated platform, the Predator, between the Air Force and the CIA. They had not quite finished working out the rules of engagement and the command lines of responsibility. What they needed was a blanket permission, following people on types of people. You see him, you shoot.
Mm-hmm. And the Predator was the drone.
That's the drone that used to only spy and now has been armed with a missile, the Hellfire missile.
You say that advisors who are defending the administration policy are saying this wasn't such a grave error, are asserting that his fate, that is, this fate of this one man, should not be a measure of U.S. success in the war.
That's right. After September 11th, the president talked about wanting bin Laden dead or alive and public enemy number one. And by last month, when that job clearly became quite difficult, he started saying words even as far as, "I honestly am not that worried about him, or not that concerned about him," were the president's words, that this is an operation against a whole terrorist infrastructure and so on. There's a lot to that, but it's ludicrous to say that the top guy of the organization you're trying to destroy is not a vital target.
Sure. Several weeks ago, Tom Daschle was attacked as unpatriotic for essentially saying this.
Well, it behooves the administration to have as free a rein in running the war as it can, and anytime someone of the opposite party raises a question, they're going to say that they're attacking the war, or even, you know, you're attacking the fighting men and women in uniform and so on. That's an old trick that's been used many times.
Yeah, but he essentially said the war isn't a success until we meet the president's objective, which originally was wanted dead or alive.
Well, I think, in truth, that's the view inside the administration as well, but they've decided it's no longer smart for them to say so.
Barton Gellman writes for The Washington Post. He spoke to us earlier today from New York. The North London neighborhood of Finsbury Park seems an unlikely place to nurture jihad. Yet inside the North London Central Mosque, Abu Hamza al-Masri regularly preaches to prospective holy warriors and sells videos made by Islamic extremists. His mosque is only one node in a network of potential terrorist support cells in London. London isn't the only European locus for anti-terrorism, however. Right now, five men suspected to have links to al-Qaeda are on trial in Frankfurt. What can the U.S. do to root out terror nestled inside European borders? And how does the known presence of terrorists in Europe, in London, affect your travel plans? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now from St. Andrews, Scotland, is Professor Paul Wilkinson. He's chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University and special advisor to the Government Commission charged with reformulating Britain's anti-terrorism legislation. Welcome, Paul Wilkinson.
Good evening.
Paul Wilkinson, how long have these terrorist support cells been in Europe, and what were the first hints of their existence?
They have been there for some years, certainly dating back before the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. It does appear that the intelligence community in Europe, like the intelligence community in America, really missed the important developments of cells, preparative cells, the development of support networks for al-Qaeda. And where these activities were noticed, the importance of these developments, the dangers of these developments, did not apparently strike home to the authorities. And so inadequate measures were taken to respond to this emerging terrorist network.
People knew there might be something up, but they just didn't know what that was.
That's right. I think the French probably had more accurate information than other countries. As you know, they have a long tradition of very good intelligence on the Islamic world. And I think if there had been closer attention to the French reports on developments as they saw them, we could have all benefited, and perhaps some more preventive action could have been taken in the benefit of hindsight. I think it was a pity that we didn't pay more attention to the French growing knowledge of these networks. Of course, they had good reason to study them, because the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, an Algerian group, was actually engaged in terrorism in France itself and it in turn was penetrated by Al-Qaeda and similar radical political Islamist movements. And so the French were building up data on this network when countries like the United Kingdom were really concentrating their attention on other kinds of terrorist threat.
Mm. Well, what was the investigative path? Can you lay it out for us that led back from the August 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa, to which you alluded, to London?
Well, it became clear that a number of the people who had been active in European cells, people not only identified as being a resident in the United Kingdom, but also people who turned up in France, Germany, the Netherlands, it was discovered that they had links, some of them, with Britain, and that particular mosques in the United Kingdom were clearly important sources of recruitment. And a number of people have traced those connections Europe-wide. So clearly the propaganda activities and recruiting activities in the United Kingdom were significant and helped to enable the organization to spread its network, to gain fresh recruits. And I think what hasn't been perhaps adequately understood by those who are not specialized in the study of terrorism is that a number of the people who have been traced as key members of the Al-Qaeda organization were not new migrants from Middle Eastern countries or from Islamic countries. They were, in some cases, native to the European countries. They were converted, as it were, to these ideas. Or they were second-generation migrants from middle-class families, in many cases from quite prosperous backgrounds, well-educated, but people who were contacted by radical preachers, sometimes through a mosque, sometimes through personal contacts, propaganda videos, and similar kinds of contact. And those people were drawn into the organization. And of course, because they had lived in the West for some time, the problem of merging with their surroundings, moving easily around the Western cities, a knowledge of how to evade police attention, all that came very easily to them, and it was difficult for the authorities to identify these people as members of a global terrorist network.
And yet their Western acclimatization didn't make them proof against this sort of anti-Western appeal.
Absolutely, and I think this is one of the worrying features of this global network. We have to recognize that in the United States, as in Europe, there are people who are, if you like, vulnerable to being lured into this organization. And the effort to try to counter this kind of propaganda activity is really very important, and I don't think we've placed enough stress on this educative task, if you like, within the Muslim community. And of course, we need to enlist the leaders of the Muslim community, the community elders, the people who are the imams of the mosques, because their influence is obviously considerable, and they need to be helped and encouraged to take a stand against these extremists, who in many cases, by the way...
We'll be right back to you, Professor Wilkinson. Just hang on a second. We just have to identify ourselves. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is
This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the problematics of fighting terrorism on friendly soil in Europe, in London, perhaps in your vacation destination. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Professor Paul Wilkinson, one of Britain's foremost experts on terrorism. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Professor Wilkinson. You use the phrase terrorist support cells. What is a terrorist support cell? What does it do?
It provides the essential funding, the weaponry, the safe houses, other kinds of resources which are vital to the operational people who are going to carry out terrorist attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it is clear that Al-Qaeda has resources scattered over a very a large number of countries. And it has people with the expertise to use these resources. And although the European and American authorities have clearly greatly increased their knowledge of Al-Qaeda since 11 September, and the cooperation has enormously improved, so there is now a very high level of cooperation, we know that there are still many people out there who have not yet been identified who are still capable of attacks, and mm-hmm. that is why we need not only to remain vigilant, but to maintain the effort to enhance the intelligence effort. That's the big key to success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was just mentioning another aspect of this campaign, which I think has been neglected, and that is enlisting the mainstream religious leaders to counter the efforts of the extremists who are using the mosques or using the facilities of the Muslim community without the agreement or knowledge, in many cases, of the community leaders.
Mm-hmm.
To recruit people into their ranks. And, of course, you don't need large numbers of people to create very dangerous terrorist cells. There was an interesting public opinion poll in the Netherlands showing after the 11 September tragedy, showing that the majority of Muslims in the Netherlands strongly condemned the attacks. But it was clear that about 11% supported the idea of a jihad against America. And, of course, it's among that group that you would find a small, hard core of people who would carry that even further and actually join and support terrorist violence against Western targets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Within Western countries.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think we should recognize we're dealing with very small numbers.
Yes.
But very small numbers can do damage, can take many lives, as we've seen in the United States.
Yes, we did. 19 terrorists taking the lives of 3,000 Americans.
Exactly. Let's
take a call from NJ. Hello. Welcome.
Good evening. I just want to make a comment about this curious idea that's floating about that if somebody is somehow within the milieu of a particular kind of civilization, that they wouldn't feel the necessity to lash out against that civilization or that context that they find there's antagonistic towards them. I mean, after all, many of the independence seekers in America 200 or so years ago did live in the Western milieu themselves.
That's certainly a good point. I think I was raising my eyebrow about the point that Professor Wilkinson had made, that these were not only new immigrants but people who were perhaps even second generation rooted that far in British soil. And perhaps naively, I guess I assumed that those roots would somehow protect them against essentially rejecting all that Britain stands for. Professor Wilkinson, your comment on that?
I think that there is an interesting phenomenon of alienation among particularly certain young people in the Muslim community, which can lead to small numbers of individuals being attracted into these extreme violent organizations. And we find that if we research into the organizations, that they're really very clever at putting their propaganda across, indoctrinating young people. And it's interesting that a number of them, you see, who've been described by their friends and colleagues have been people who were not thought to be particularly extreme, indeed not particularly interested mm-hmm. in radical political or religious ideas. And very suddenly, they seem to get swept up by these organizations and almost undergo a sort of 180-degree turn in their lives to become potential suicide bombers of Al-Qaeda.
This fits the profile of Richard Reid, the attempted shoe bomber.
That's right, and also Mousawi, who spent some period in London, and prior to that was thought of as a perfectly moderate person without any extreme ideas, and suddenly he gets into contact with people with these very violent ideas in London through a network connected with a mosque. And lo and behold, he turns out to be totally committed to this cause.
Mm-hmm. NJ, would you like to respond, add anything more?
Yes, please. I think that in as much as I agree entirely with what the professor said, I think that there's a simplistic way in which it's presented. And in addition, I think only sort of in hindsight do we look back in some cases, and in most cases, say whether or not what somebody did or did not do was laudable. Terrible as the consequences are, I believe that the fact that the majority of the world looks upon what they do as heinous, and rightly so, the majority of the chattering classes would have said much the same thing about some of the independence struggles, the one I alluded to here in America, and some of the ones that happened in Africa and other places. So that a lot of times there are particularly heinous methods used, but I think that this particular dwelling on this particular aspect of sort of how the people were recruited and why it is they, you know, obviously didn't see this wonderful sort of world in which we live.
Yeah.
As somehow presented, usually very,
mm-hmm.
very simplistically.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just come back on that?
Sure.
I think that it's very important to see that the distinction between a political struggle for national independence of a particular ethno-nationalist group and a campaign which is explicitly committed to killing as many Americans, including civilians, as possible in a kind of religious ideological war, which is a much more destructive kind of terrorism mm-hmm. and which has given rise, after all, to the greatest acts of mass destruction committed by a sub-state terrorist organization in modern history.
Mm.
That's a very different kind of phenomenon from the campaigns that we saw in, for example, Asia, Africa, in the 70s and 60s, where people were fighting for separate nations.
Now, NJ, thank you for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Wilkinson, is there you're describing the difference between a freedom fighter in say Kenya 40 years ago, and a terrorist in Britain today? Is the terror is the act of mass murder represented to the recruit in that way? Or is there a generalized indoctrination in hatred without specifically being linked to some conscience-enabling or, one would hope, conscience-stirring specific? I'm thinking, for example, that in the September 11th attack, several of the people, I think the bulk of the attackers only realized that this was a suicide mission when it was underway. course, they may have realized it was a murder mission from the beginning. I guess that's the question.
I think they must have realized that it was a murder mission from the outset.
Right.
And if one reads the statements of bin Laden, the notorious declaration of war against America and the so-called fatwa of 1998, it's quite clear that the organization is saying that it is actually a duty of Muslims everywhere to participate in this activity of killing as many Americans as possible, whenever, wherever they can do that. Now, that is rather different from the kind of strategy that the more traditional kind of terrorist organization has followed. And I would make two distinctions here, which I think are very important. One is between, you know, the traditional type of terrorist organization with a campaign going on in a particular country or in a particular region of a country where all their activity is concentrated, and an organization which is waging a kind of global campaign like Al-Qaeda. And the other important distinction is between what I would call a corrigible terrorist organization, one where there is some political agenda which could be reasonably addressed by the international community or by governments, and the incorrigible type of group, which is making demands of such an absolutist and totally unrealizable nature. That there is no question of finding some kind of political solution by addressing the roots of the problem, because their terrorism is dependent upon this kind of internalized belief system and their hatred, their fierce hatred for their declared enemy. And you just can't deal with that politically or diplomatically. You have to deal with it, as we've been talking about earlier, by trying to improve the intelligence gathering and the criminal justice approach, which would enable you to dismantle the cells. And ultimately, I think it is the intelligence battle and the criminal justice effort, which is going to take time, but which has to go on, which will ultimately bring about the defeat of the Al-Qaeda network.
Yeah. Kevin is on the line with a question about sort of how the Europeans are looking at terrorism and the issue of sort of international cooperation in rooting it out. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Yeah. You know, I was in Europe a couple of months ago, and I was taken back by to how many people, and not experts, but people in day-to-day affairs, people you struck up conversations with, who would who seem to have been disagreeing with the it was, you know, the war was going on quite, it was hot in Afghanistan, and the approach America was taking, you know, the militarization of it. They seem to have preferred some kind of police, not military police action, but, you know, police investigations, you know, going after cells, as opposed to the, in a cooperative way. And they almost seem to have were feeling that the U.S. was going about the wrong way, and especially they talked about, you know, hooking up with the Indonesian military, the Philippines, Colombia, that we were seeing the problem not quite in the most constructive way. And I was wondering if, you know, your guest would, you know, comment on that. You know, has the United States gone about it in the best way possible? And how does he see how we should differentiate the problem as a military problem as opposed to a police investigatory problem?
Thank you, Kevin. Professor Wilkinson?
Well, I think having visited many countries since 11 September, I can safely say that the vast majority of Europeans are fully supportive of the war in Afghanistan. They can see the importance of destroying the safe haven, the base that the leadership of Al-Qaeda have been using. And particularly, they can see the importance, of course, of capturing or killing the leader himself, because, after all, he has been the mastermind of this organization, Osama bin Laden. There's no doubt that the European countries are fully behind that. And as you know, Britain and some other European countries have forces in Afghanistan or are involved in other ways mm-hmm. in supporting mm-hmm. that campaign, and they are fully committed, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
Where there is, a divergence of opinion about how to deal with the terrorism threat is on the matter of widening the conflict, as your listener noted. Europeans are not convinced that mm-hmm. it is a good idea to use the military method in a larger and larger number of countries. The axis of evil countries, the mm-hmm. Countries which were mentioned by your listener, Indonesia and the Philippines and other countries, and for example Iraq. The Europeans generally feel that widening the war in this way is not necessarily going to bring about the defeat of
mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, it might actually be counterproductive because it could break up the international coalition, particularly weakening the support for the coalition against terrorism in the Arab world and among the Muslim countries generally. And we need their cooperation
mm.
because, of course, intelligence sharing, criminal investigation assistance and so on from countries like Pakistan is so important, and we should not put at risk that cooperation by taking military action that is not really seen as urgently necessary for security reasons. We have been containing Iraq mm-hmm. with its dangerous and aggressive regime for many years. And I think most European observers and experts believe that we should continue to do that
mm-hmm.
and certainly use every possible channel, diplomatic and political and economic lever to pressure the Saddam regime into allowing weapons inspectors back into the country so that we can monitor the,
right.
the weapons of mass destruction program and ensure that it is stopped. But I think that is the main divergence.
Yes.
There are minor criticisms.
Yeah, I was going to say about, for example, the American death penalty. The French have said they don't want to cooperate with us because one of the people we have under charge now may face a death penalty, and he has French roots.
Well, we have to remember that difference of view between the Europeans and the Americans goes back a long time.
A long time.
We've had a situation where most European countries have now for some time dispensed with the death penalty. And, of course, that does mean that there are technical difficulties in extraditing to a country that still has the death penalty.
Right.
But I think we can overcome that problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, indeed, it is being overcome, as I understand it, by an arrangement whereby the American authorities would...
Hold that thought, Professor Wilkinson. Just hold that thought just 1 minute. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Al-Qaeda cells in Europe and more specifically in London, or Londonistan, as it's being called, the center, some people think, of these terrorist cells in Europe. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Paul Wilkinson, who is a expert on terrorism in the United Kingdom. Paul Wilkinson, earlier we were mentioning the constraints the Europeans feel in cooperating with the Americans. The Guardian in February said that it had seen documents from France and Germany and Spain which showed that most of the known attacks planned or executed by Al-Qaeda in the last 4 years had involved British roots and indeed London roots. I guess I'm wondering, why London? And is there – here we have interned hundreds of Muslim young men, and according to Amnesty International today, we have mistreated them. But we've just rounded them up and put them in jail. And I'm wondering, is there more of a political constraint on Britain's being as tough with its possible suspects as we are here, since unfortunately for them, Muslims are a tiny minority in this country.
Well, can I just go back to that point you made about the death penalty difference between Europe and America being a constraint? I think it would be a great pity if we allow it to get in the way of combating terrorism. I think the way to overcome it is for America to have an arrangement whereby those extradited from European countries will be given maximum prison sentences for serious terrorist crimes, but not the death penalty. And we have to remember that actually long periods of imprisonment are dreaded by terrorists. They really are greatly influenced by that, and there is some evidence that they may be deterred by the threat of long-term imprisonment.
So, well, as a matter of fact, Moussaoui, who would have been the 20th suicide bomber, was sent to his trial as being held in a Virginia jurisdiction of the federal bench because it is known to be much more tougher in regard to the death penalty.
Yeah, well, I can understand that that response, but I do think in the interests of dismantling this this network worldwide, we have to be pragmatic about sentencing. The important thing is to capture the people who have been involved, find the evidence, and convict them on the evidence, so that they can be punished and the justice can be seen to be done by the world at large. And I think that can be done. And the American justice system has shown that it can perform extremely well in these very difficult cases of trials of terrorists. Now, if I can go on to the point you've just made about political constraints, I do think that there has been a reluctance in European countries, not just in Britain, but in Europe generally, to crack down hard on extremism and support for political violence among the Muslim community, partly out of a concern that this might be interpreted as racist or xenophobic or discriminatory. And I think that, again, is something we have to overcome. This campaign is not a campaign against a particular religion. It is certainly not a war against Islam. It is a campaign against terrorism, which is a very serious crime against human rights and which has become now a strategic threat because of the scale of terrorist attack that the Al-Qaeda committed in America in September. And therefore, we need to concentrate our minds on tackling the terrorism and not allowing ourselves to be distracted by these other side issues.
Yes, and I can imagine from the American side that is a an urgent request on the Europeans. Ed is on the line. Hello.
Hello there, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Yes, when Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of England, said that Gorbachev was a man the West could do business with, and the Cold War came to an end, there were people back then, like a decade ago or more, saying we don't want to make the Muslim world now the new big boogeyman. You know, to turn our military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about towards the Muslim or Arab world. Now, it seems to me that while Europe, France, England, particularly the Brits, are kind of skittish when it comes to their dealings with the Muslims and the Arabs and their support for Israel, America is sort of out of the closet. It's kind of reminiscent of the daylight bombing by the B-17s versus the Brits' Lancaster's bombing at night. And America learned that B-17s bombing at day, those flying fortresses, that it really, we got hurt, you know, by doing that. And I think that this terrorism is going to come to America if we support this all-out Muslim war.
You know,
thank you very much.
No, I appreciate your call, Ed. Comment on that, Paul Wilkinson?
Yes, I agree that it is very dangerous to be perceived as waging a war against Islam. That would be an absurd and very dangerous thing to do. And of course, it provides a tremendous propaganda weapon to Osama bin Laden and his henchmen. If political leaders in the West or opinion leaders start saying that kind of thing, if they begin to, as it were, equate Islam with terrorism, this is as crazy as equating Christianity with terrorism just mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, some organizations that have mm-hmm. been involved in terrorism claim mm-hmm. to be listening to the voice of God, and we know there are
right.
groups of that
right.
sort,
right.
even in America.
Right.
We would be insulted if people said that that was a fair representation of Christianity. We
right.
must distinguish between Islam and the Islamic
yes,
religion, which is a peaceful religion,
right.
and these violent extremists
mm-hmm.
who really have a political agenda but use or abuse religious ideas and doctrines
mm-hmm.
to try and justify it.
Briefly, Professor, the Financial Times had a series recently that basically concluded Al-Qaeda is preparing a second punch, and that Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, might have been a kind of probe in that direction. What's the thinking in Britain?
I think that most British experts would agree that Al-Qaeda is still a dangerous force. They are still able to train people. They have access to training facilities in countries far away from Afghanistan, as you know, and we haven't been able yet to eradicate that apparatus. We haven't been able to capture the people who are providing the support. We still have a great way to go in bringing in all the finances and seizing the assets that they're using to fund their activities. So there's a huge task to be done. And in the meantime, of course, there is a threat
mm.
of further Al-Qaeda attacks. The disruption of the organization through the successes of the forces in Afghanistan will certainly have helped to make it more difficult for Al-Qaeda, but it has not put them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
I think European experts are quite sure that we still have a danger of further attacks, and for that reason, we need maximum multinational cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that any of us can tackle individually. Even a superpower like the United States has to have global cooperation in order to eradicate this very dangerous network.
Thank you, Paul Wilkinson. Paul Wilkinson is a professor at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University. Could an attack on Saddam Hussein lead to Muslim unrest in Britain? Find out more by going to our website. The address is onpointradio.org. Coming up, a retired gay priest reflects on homosexuality, pedophilia, and the Vatican. This is On Point. Next week, American cardinals will go to the Vatican to discuss the problems of sexual abuse and pedophilia in the Catholic Church. Among the topics of discussion will be homosexuality in the priesthood. John McNeil is a retired Catholic priest who has ministered to the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered community for the past 35 years. He's also a trained psychotherapist and author of four books on gay theology and spirituality. He himself is gay and troubled about the outcome of next week's conference, especially if there's any attempt to link pedophilia with homosexuality.
In my 35 years of work with gays in general, and literally with hundreds of gay priests, I have encountered only one truly pedophile gay priest. He was dealing with a deep sexual pathology, which had only an accidental connection with his gayness. In my mind, the real underlying issue has to do with the Catholic Church's demand that every priest live a celibate lifestyle. The Church itself teaches that the grace to live a celibate life in a healthy and fulfilling way is a special gift of God given to only a few. In my own case, I found myself compulsively acting out my sexual needs, leading to profound depression and even suicidal thought. I came to the personal conclusion that a church teaching that destroys the psychic health of thousands of people must be wrong. What is bad psychology had to be bad theology. Once I met a gay man with whom I developed a deep relationship of love and friendship. I was able to accept my gayness as a gift from God and rejoice in it. This experience of gay love transformed my relationship with God from one based primarily on fear to one based in a profound experience of God's love for me. I found this equally true for most of my gay priest clients. The craving in all my clients and in myself over the years was not primarily one for sexual pleasure, but a much more profound craving for an experience of human intimacy. During Vatican Council II, the Catholic Church began the process of revising its teaching on human sexuality. For centuries, it saw all sexual pleasure, even that of husband and wife, as sinful. It could only be justified by the intention of procreation. But in Vatican II, the Church began to teach there are two co-equal ends that God intended for human sexuality, procreation and mutual love and fulfillment. It approved marital sex in infertile periods because it would still fulfill the God-given primary end of human sexuality as mutual love and fulfillment. Right at that moment, the Vatican should have reconsidered its teaching on homosexuality. Homosexual relationships can and do fulfill the God-given purpose of mutual love and fulfillment. But the Vatican remained too blinded by its homophobia to be able to make that move. The Holy Spirit is using this crisis of authority to lead the faithful into a new, mature autonomy in their spiritual life. I still hope and pray that the Holy Spirit will lead the Church through the convening of a new world council to a serious reevaluation of its understanding of human sexuality in general and of homosexuality in particular. I hope and pray that it will stop tying the grace of vocation to the priesthood to a necessary and enforced celibacy and leave the choice of a celibate lifestyle up to the conscience and discernment of the individual. I hope and pray that the Church can begin to listen carefully to what the Holy Spirit is saying to it through its lesbian and gay members and stop assuming a priori that it has all the answers. If any of this happens, this crisis could turn out to be a great blessing.
John McNeil is the author of four books on gay theology and spirituality. He lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Listeners, we want to hear your story on our program. Diaries like this one start with an email from you. We're looking for essays, emails, and letters of around 750 words in length. How are the conflicts abroad and the anxieties at home touching you? Your diaries can be about the turmoil in the Middle East, the crisis in the Catholic Church, the beginning of the baseball season, any subject in the news that is affecting your life. Send in submissions for future diaries to onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian.